Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
I first met George Stephanopoulos when he was a young deputy to Governor Bill Clinton of Arkansas, who was running for president. George trailed behind him, thick Coke bottle, glasses, and an even thicker file of papers under his arm. He went on to great prominence as a key to that election victory and a top White House aide during the first term of Bill Clinton, and then began a career in journalism that has taken him to the heights as chief anchor for ABC News. His Sunday show is a staple for people who care about public affairs, and as host of Good Morning America. George is as knowledgeable and passionate about government and politics as any journalist in the country. He's also one of the most decent and honorable people I've ever known. I sat down with him on a recent visit to New York to talk about where we are in our politics and in journalism. That conversation in a second, but one viewer note, we're going to a slimmed-down summer schedule for the Axe Files, one a week, and we'll be back to our two-a-week schedule in the fall. George Stephanopoulos, good to see you.
Welcome. Welcome to my house.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
It makes it easier for me. You came to me. It's great.
That's how we roll. I thought one of the most vivid exchanges that you had on your Sunday show was with Reverend Dobson Focus on the Family.
Well, you have to remind me.
Well, you questioned him on the morality of a position he was taking, and he said, "Are you going to lecture me on morality?" And there was a hint of you being sort of a-religious, and the reason it struck me so is because I know you and I know your history, and you grew up in a very faith-driven household.
Oh, that's for sure. Son, grandson, nephew, godson of a Greek Orthodox priest, yeah. I mean, I used to joke, my family business until I sort of broke the string, went bad and went into politics. My grandfather on my father's side came here, I guess, in 1936 and was basically the Greek Orthodox priest for the entire West. He went straight out to Great Falls, Montana, and covered that whole territory. That was a time when Greeks there had been about two or three waves of immigration, but that was one of them, obviously, right before World War II. The family gradually made its way east, and my dad was born in Greece, but he grew up in both Ohio and Pennsylvania. My grandfather had parishes there, and in fact, my dad ended up serving for several years, 8 years in the Cleveland Parish, which is right adjacent to the one where my grandfather had served.
And so this was a presence, a pervasive thing in your...
How
did that impact on you?
It was what I knew. I mean, so I always felt like I was living in, because I'm sort of a first and a half generation Greek. As I said, my dad was born in Greece. My mom was born here, but she was also the daughter of immigrants who had come here. Her father came here around 1918, worked on the railroads, worked his way out west all the way to Utah, made it back to east to Minnesota, settled in Rochester, Minnesota, and opened up a shoe repair shop on Main Street in Rochester. So my parents were really hardcore first generation Greeks, where you're really brought up, and that is you're Greek American. I was kind of American Greek, but still living in that world where, you know, sort of the whole rhythms of my life were set to the church. Our calendar was set to the church. That was our community. Yet I would also, you know, sort of go out into the world, public school, and you're exposed to something else. So I really felt like I had my foot in two very different worlds when I was growing up.
Did you ever consider going into the priesthood?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, I thought that's what I assumed I would be, I guess up until around, I was, 14, when it sort of hit me that I wasn't going to be a priest. And I didn't say anything about it for a few years because I kind of felt betrayal is a slightly too strong a word, but it had been the expectation that I had grown up with, whether it was put on me or not. It just what I assumed. And then when I realized that wasn't the path I was going to follow, I felt, I guess, almost embarrassed or abashed about coming out and talking about it. Now, it turned out my parents were great about it. It was something much more that I was feeling than something that was being imposed on me. But yeah, that's what I assumed I was going to do.
Now, there are some who would say that you've made the journey from the sacred to the profane.
Yeah, it went as bad as I could go, right?
So how did your interest in politics grow?
Well, it was something also, I think, we grew up with, not so much partisan politics, but, you know, I grew up in a house where my parents read the newspapers and watched the news on television and talked about what was going on. And that was something that was always part of our lives. I didn't get a full spark. I wasn't like the kind of kid in grade school or high school. Like, I have friends, let's see, I was 12 the summer of the Watergate hearings. I have to commit, that wasn't a big part of my life at 12. I had a lot of friends my age they were really into it then. For me, at that stage of my life, I was, you know, caddying and hanging out with my friends and, you know, going to the pool.
Sounds
in the summer, pretty normal. Yeah. But it sort of hit me much more, I would say, in college. I had some great professors, and I actually remember my first political job. I was a freshman at Columbia, and I put out signs at the subway for Carter Burden, who I think was running for Congress at the time. He was on the city council, was running for Congress at the time. And I got much more involved over the course of college. And then for me, the real turning point was my junior year of college. I had been taking more political science classes. I'd been caring about it a lot more. And I had an internship with my local congresswoman. They called it the LBJ internship at that time. I think it was $500 a month for June in the summer, and that was the summer of 1981. The Reagan tax cuts were going through the Congress, and Mary Rose Elcar was the member of Congress.
Oh, yes. Local in Cleveland.
Local in Cleveland. Yeah. She was, you know, standing on the front lines fighting Social Security cuts, and I think I wrote my first statement for the Congressional Record, and I was hooked for life.
And was there any connection between, you know, faith and sort of the tenets of faith that led you?
The idea that you have responsibility for the world beyond yourself. And, you know, the basic idea that we have to love one another as we love ourselves, and that you carry that simple idea through, I think, to public policy. And at some level, putting other people even, not fully before yourself, but certainly on an equal plane. And I think you can sort of derive principles of a lot of public policy. Now, you're always going to disagree on the details of how to achieve that. But I think the basic driving philosophy for me, political philosophy for me, comes from that.
How'd your folks take it when you veered into the political direction?
I think they were of two minds at first. I think my parents have actually gotten more liberal, more democratic over time. But at first, it wasn't about the partisanship. It was like a lot of first generation families, the idea is that, again, if I wasn't going to be a priest,
be a lawyer.
You got it. Yeah. Or a doctor. I was never going to be a doctor, so that wasn't going to happen.
Cards.
But you had to you had to sort of have that professional credential. And that was the next period of my life where I spent a few years kind of not dissembling, but not talking too much about what exactly I wanted to do. I took that first internship junior year, and then again to be senior year of college, and I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. I went two paths again then. I applied to the Peace Corps, but also applied for some internships again in Washington. And kind of at the last minute, got one at the Carnegie Endowment. And I ended up taking that, and I said to my parents, I had already taken the LSATs, let me just do this for a year. And then that was an election year, 1982. Another member of Congress from Cleveland got elected, a guy named Ed Fian.
Yes.
You might have remembered him.
Yes. Yeah, I remember him not just from his service in Congress, but from this titanic race with Dennis Kucinich for mayor of Cleveland.
Yeah, they were 27 and 28 years old. Did you probably cover it?
I don't know. Yeah, I did. I was at the Tribune, and they sent me to cover that
Because that was a big deal at the time. It was these two young men under 30.
Did you work in that race?
No, I mean, that would have been 1977. I was 16 again. That was, no, that was before I had a real political awakening, but I remembered it. And yeah, he lost to Dennis Kucinich, but then ended up in Congress. And it was the same thing. My internship was running out in December. I could have gone on to law school, I guess, in that September, but I wasn't quite ready yet, still hadn't scratched the itch completely. And I met Ed.
Now, have you completely ruled that out?
Law school?
Yes.
You know, the truth, I mean, this is getting us off on another tangent. One of the things I like best about the career I've been lucky enough to have, both working in Congress, working in campaigns, working in the White House, and then at ABC, I've gotten to deal with the best parts of the law and without all the drudgery.
Yeah.
I mean, all the big constitutional, big public policy issues, we study them all the time. We talk about them all the time. And I've learned a lot about them, but without becoming a lawyer.
So you stay with Fian for
I worked for him. Let's see, that was 80. He started in 83. Yeah, and then in the fall of 83, I kept wanting to put it off again. So I told my parents, let me take one more shot because it would buy me another year. I'll apply for the Rhodes Scholarship. I had applied in college and didn't get it. This was a thing where so much of that hinges on your interviews. And working for 2 years had made a big difference. And right when that job was about to end, I got the road. So I went to England for a couple of years, and that pretty much put law school to bed. But I had a nice credential.
Consolation for your folks too.
Right. That's what happened. And then after that, one thing led to another.
Yeah. Well, one thing it led to was you working for Mike Dukakis when he ran for president. How did that come? Obviously, there was an attraction there, Greek-American running
Greek
for president.
Short Greek guy with no sense of humor is my old joke, but yeah, he's got a pretty good one. It was a haphazard thing. I had a great experience at Oxford where actually when I came back, it was the first time I had tried to go full-time into television journalism. Because when I was at Oxford, I had taken the, you go there and it's a great schedule. You go to school for 8 weeks and then you're off for six, three times a year.
Yeah, that's nice.
And in my first two long breaks, at the time there was a famine in Sudan. And I took my first break and volunteered with the International Rescue Committee and saved the children and was doing some work there, but also did my first journalism. I was a stringer for the Christian Science Monitor. I wrote two articles on the famine, and it's such a mind-bogglingly different world. I would handwrite the articles, and I think I called them in to some 1-800 number from a phone booth in Khartoum.
Yeah,
and then it got. But I remember that was that thrill, which you lived with early in your career as well, the first time you see a byline on something that you really cared about and you felt like you were telling the world.
Yeah, I also felt when I was a reporter that actually calling stories in was an exhilarating thing.
Yeah.
Sometimes on deadline, the rush of having to tell the story, tell it quickly, tell it correctly was...
And at that time, I actually then got hooked up with At the time, there was a small CBS documentary running on Sunday mornings then, and I had met another former student at Oxford when I came back and told him about my trip. And we ended up going back on my next break, and we filmed these two shows. And it turned out that we were there at that time, while we were there filming these documentaries on the famine, there was a coup. And so I ended up doing more journalism for the Christian Science Monitor then. And so I thought, came out of that thinking, boy, maybe I want to do this, you know. And I ended up teasing both Rick Kaplan and Ted Koppel about this for many years afterwards. One of the places I applied when I came back from Oxford was Nightline. And I got a reply. It was one sentence basically saying, we have no use for you. So I went back to Ed Fian and was his chief of staff for about a year and a half. But I did want to get involved in a campaign. And the attraction to Mike Dukakis was you know, very strong. Greek-American, first Greek-American had a real shot. Agnew kind of didn't count. And you probably know him. I'm sure you know him. Nick Metropoulos was my connection to that campaign. And I ended up doing a bunch of jobs at the beginning. I went up to Concord during the New Hampshire primary. And then was full-time as the communications director for the Ohio primary, where Jesse Jackson was still a factor then. And then I went to Boston in June, when, you know, everybody was just measuring their office for the drapes for the office in the White House.
Well, famously, Dukakis was 17 points ahead
at the convention. But I this is how much the world has changed. I was part of the rapid response unit for you guys couldn't see the air quotes
on the podcast.
That's like
being on the Jamaican bobsled team.
That's exactly right. We were so pathetic. And, you know, again, the old time, the way we would get the news was literally an old time AP ticker in the corner of the office. The first days of our research was sort of LexisNexis. Kind of making myself feel so old here. That August, we got decimated, and you could feel it happening. But, you know, coming off the high of the convention, but, you know, Dukakis had this thing where it was a little old-fashioned, and he, to his credit and his detriment, he believed that he's a hyper-rational man, hyper-principled person, who believes that that's sort of the way everybody else is or should be, too. And he couldn't believe that the attacks that they started to launch, starting with even sending Ronald Reagan out to kind of kick off the idea that he was, quote, invalid, and setting up rumors about his mental health problems, but then going on to the Boston Harbor and the Willie Horton.
Right.
And, you know, the defense stuff was just, by the end of August, we were in so much trouble.
We should note it was Roger Ailes who was the mastermind behind that campaign. And to this day, I think it probably was the most effective negative campaign in a presidential race.
6 weeks completely turned everything around.
Yeah,
I mean, by the people still talk about and you know, now I know better. I mean, I think I felt like, boy, we were still in it in October. When I look back at it, we weren't.
Although what happened in the debate probably strengthened a negative impression.
It sort of reinforced. I think you could argue that Dukakis had a chance in the debates to come back.
Yeah.
But, you know, once
we should remind those who don't remember or know that he got a question on what he would do. He was opposed to the death penalty, got a question on what he would do if his wife had been raped and murdered. Would he support the death penalty for that person?
And he just gave this very deadpanned answer why he's opposed to the death penalty, as opposed to any emotion on what it would feel like if someone killed his wife or hurt his wife, and it just...
So after this Willie Horton campaign, it just reinforced a negative that was deadly. Did you know Dukakis? Did you get to know him during that campaign?
A little bit. I didn't travel, though. And so, I mean, I would see him a lot, and I admire him still. I mean, was that actually at a...
He was a fine governor.
Fine governor. I to this day, I mean, I still regret that during the Clinton administration... we didn't find a place for him in the cabinet. I think he would have been an excellent Secretary of Health and Human Services, Transportation, HUD, anything. He's dedicated his life to public policy and public service, and he's just been tremendous at it. He's been teaching ever since.
Kind of odd because Bill Clinton gave the nominating speech for Mike Dukakis, famously. I think it's he's still talking now. It went on for quite a while.
You look at that's one of the things you think about Bill Clinton, though. How many times has he been introduced, dismissed, and then come back?
Yeah. In fact, he was really innovative. Then I think he went on the Tonight Show,
and Johnny Carson. Yeah.
And he made fun of himself for the length.
And now that
just
becomes standard operating procedure.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk about Bill Clinton. You went to work for Dick Gephardt.
I went to work
turned out to be Dukakis's principal opponent in that primary in 88.
In 88. And that was one of the other points in my life where I thought I was leaving politics. I actually first, after the campaign, I really did the circuit. But I first interviewed with both Al Gore and Joe Biden coming out to join their Senate offices. Neither one worked out, but I had, at the same time, I had known Father Timothy Healy, who was the president of Georgetown, who was becoming the president of New York Public Library. And he was moving up here, and he asked me to be his chief of staff, executive assistant. That sounded like a pretty interesting opportunity as well. I did that. Again, I wasn't done. And that spring, I guess it was late spring of 1989, there was a wholesale replacement of the entire Democratic leadership. Jim Wright, Bill Gray both left, and Dick Gephardt became the Democratic leader. And through another great political operator fixer, Kirk O'Donnell, who I'd worked with in the Dukakis campaign, he hooked me up with Gephardt as he was majority leader, for an interview on becoming his chief floor staff. Which I've had I'm so grateful. I've had a lot of great jobs in my life. In some ways, that was one of my favorite job.
But talk about being right in the middle of the action.
You're right in the middle of the action, and it's politics on every single level. You have to know the personalities of every member of the Democratic caucus and some Republicans as well, and what moves them. You have to know the issues, and you have to know the politics. And it was just great, great training. And you're there on the floor every single day talking to members of Congress and being in the strategy meetings with the speaker on how you're going to approach the new White House. And it was just it was an incredible education, an incredible thrill, and really fun.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with George Stephanopoulos. You arrived there not just after a period of time when there was a shakeup in the Democratic leadership, but shortly there'd be a shakeup in the Republican leadership. Newt Gingrich affected the purge of Bob Michael, who was a moderate Republican from Illinois.
I remember what precipitated it all. I was in the middle of that as well. That was at the time when one of the things that elected George H.W. Bush, thanks to Roger Ailes, was the promise of, you read my lips, no new taxes.
Right.
By 1990, that promise was untenable.
Untenable because of the budget was so.
Yeah, I mean, this shows how much things have changed. Untenable because it just seemed like the responsible thing to do at the time. I mean, today, I don't think the leaders would find it untenable. But at that time, they did, or he did. George Mitchell was the Democratic leader
in the Senate.
Yeah. We had Tom Foley, the speaker, and Dick Gephardt were the leaders, and they came up with a strategy that the Democrats would not negotiate until Bush explicitly said, you know, that promise is no longer viable. We're going to have to raise taxes. And you saw the beginnings of so much of what's happened politically to date right in that event. John Sununu was his chief of staff at the time, was Bush's chief of staff, and he knew how much trouble it was going to be. And even though they had another guy, Dick Darman, who was their OMB director, pushing them to, yeah, you have to do the responsible thing and raise the taxes. Sununu didn't want to do it, but they finally agreed because the Democrats wouldn't talk unless they did. But the only way they would do it was to put up a press release, tack it up to the wall of the White House, and it, as if that was going to hide what they had done. And it exploded. But
that's pretty much how they make announcements at the White House today.
Right, exactly. What happened was there was a budget summit at Andrews Air Force Base for something like 30 days. And you knew from, and I still have this image, I'm seeing it in my head right now, of Newt Gingrich. You know, you had Sununu and Darman and the for the White House. Newt was then, I guess, the number two or three in the House Republican leadership. And you could tell in all those meetings, he would be reading these pulp crime novels through the meetings and have a big stack of books and papers. And you just knew he was going to be against this thing.
Crime novels, he got the idea to stick the knife in Bob Michael's
back. Well, and that's what happened. Bob Michael and the White House reached an agreement, and Newt Gingrich led a revolt, voted it down the first time.
How much do you think you say a lot of what we're seeing today goes back to then? I sort of, you know, give Gingrich credit for sort of launching this sort of polarity in our politics, for really kind of, especially when it comes to lack of comedy in
Congress. You know, it
Congress.
Goes back further than that, though. It goes back to my first job with Ed Feehan. Ed Feehan, when he first got elected, was a part of a group of about 12 or 13 members of Congress who went to El Salvador in December, I guess, of 82, January of 83, but it was even before they were sworn in. And it was in talking about that trip and those members that Newt started the practice of speaking to an empty chamber.
Yes.
And he was basically attacking these members as being disloyal and, you know, un-American and socialist and all that. But acting as
would be televised on C-SPAN.
But then, this is before, you know, people learned how to respond to it. You had the feeling that he was saying it to their face and they weren't responding. But it was really to an empty chamber.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening was, I guess it was O'Neill who then had to start the practice of turning the cameras around during these speeches so that you could see when it was an empty chamber and when it wasn't. But it goes back to the very beginning.
Interesting, yeah. So talk about your first encounter with Bill Clinton and how you ended
That's forwarding to a couple of years later, 91. When I was hired by Dick Ephardt, it was an amazing job, but I think I was hired because he was planning on running for president.
Yeah.
And, you know, was trying to building the beginnings of a campaign team. And you go back to that time, though, January of 1991, coming out of the first Desert Storm, George Bush was at 91%
right
approval. And you had this series of top Democrats from Dick Gephardt to Al Gore to
Mario
Bill Bradley.
Cuomo.
Well, Cuomo held on a little.
Yeah,
at first he was out, and then he came back in, who just all said no to the race. I mean, everyone who was expected to run decided to take a pass, including Gephardt. But I really, you know, I was at that, I felt like I was at another point in my life where I sort of had to make a choice. Even though I loved working in the House, I didn't think I wanted to do that my entire career. And if I didn't go and do something else, I felt I would kind of
become a lifer.
And I really did, after the Dukakis experience, want to work in at least one more presidential campaign. Gephardt said no. But through mutual friends, Mark Guerin and Stan Greenberg, I was introduced to Clinton. I actually met him in Greenberg's office in September of 1991. Interestingly, I actually interviewed with both Bill Clinton and Bob Kerry on the same day. And I was attracted to both of them for very different reasons. I mean, Bob Kerry is, you know, this war hero, kind of an existential Bobby Kennedy type politician, and taking the strong stand against flag burning, you know, the flag burning amendment. And I met with him and had a great meeting with him and Billy Shore, but didn't come away with the strong sense that he had thought through the whole campaign or knew how he was going to get from here to there. Completely different experience with Clinton. Met him in Stan's office. He asked me what I did for Dukakis, and I told him, you know, they tested the jokes off me and rapid response, and he laughed. And but then really, and this is the interview was mostly him telling me how the primaries were going to go and saying basically something that turned out to be very true. He said, we're going to know on the day of the Illinois primary. And I think that's the day I'm going to wrap it up, which turned out to be true.
Yeah.
And I was just dazzled by how much he knew about everything having to do with running for president. He knew why he was running. He knew the policies that would fuel his vision, and he knew the politics cold.
He had been the chairman of the Democratic Leadership Council.
Council, yeah.
And developing kind of an alternative Democratic vision in opposition to, or as an alternative to, what was sort of traditional Democratic dogma.
Yeah, and I was I was more in the sort of traditional liberal wing of the party, but recognized that that was necessary. And also, you know, this is, again, part of Clinton's political genius. He knew, again, it partly is from how much he knew about the policy, but he knew how to speak to every side of the Democratic Party and how to, you know, I think further progressive principles in a way that people who might generally be opposed to it could accept.
Yeah.
And I think that was, you know, part of what he could do so well.
Yeah, I mean, I met with him in about the same time frame and, you know, came away, as you were, really impressed by both his grasp of politics and his grasp of policy.
That was the thing.
And to be able to combine those two things. I mean, he has a county-by-county understanding of the politics of this country. And I think part of it is being governor of a small southern state where, you know, retail politics was the coin of the realm.
And a tireless student of it for his entire life.
Yeah. Yeah. No, no doubt about it. So you signed on. I think that's when I met you. You came through Chicago.
We went to the Navy Pier.
To name David Wilhelm as a campaign manager.
That was in late October. I had started in the beginning of the month. And, it was just such a different time. I went down to Little Rock. The headquarters was a paint store, two rooms of a presidential campaign. It's when I first met your mayor, Rahm Emanuel. He started about a month after I started. I have this image of him standing on top of a table ordering people around. And he made a huge difference as well, because he was the fundraiser. And he had made sure Clinton had just enough of a stake to get by.
Because you had a rocky run there. I mean, there were other people who had written Clinton out of the
had a great October, November, December, and part of when we saw you, he was kind of on a roll, and people were seeing how special he was, and Rahm was raising at the time what seemed like,
I think he raised $4 million, and everybody was,
this is
amazed.
Like the biggest thing in the world, and that was like
lunch money today.
Nothing today, but then January was just as tough as it gets.
Jennifer Flowers,
the draft. At least two or three draft stories. I mean, plummeted.
About Clinton trying to avert the draft. And it seemed like a mortal politician would have died in those months. And
everything has been sort of turbocharged in the modern era. But the things he survived then, no one had survived before. And it was partly just his will. It was, you know, in fairness, I mean, you brought up Mario Cuomo. He actually flirted with coming back into the race in December, and to the point where he had actually had a plane waiting on the tarmac to fly to New Hampshire. And I'm sitting down in my office in Little Rock, and I think Clinton was about to get off a plane, and I think it was Tennessee. It might have been Kentucky. And, you know, we were preparing for what to do if Cuomo indeed got in. And at the time we were all acting like, oh yeah, it's a good thing if he gets in, we'll take him on. But sure enough, just before Clinton got off the plane, we got word that Cuomo decided not to get in. So I said, go, you know, don't go make the statement. A whole different thing. And he just ad-libbed a gracious statement, and it was fine. But
so some of Cuomo's virtues became more apparent in the intervening minutes there.
Oh yeah.
Before the
Although they ended up having a very complicated relationship for the next several years.
Yeah. I actually had conversations with Cuomo about that, but that campaign was a turbulent turbulent ride.
It was life support for all of January and February, but then he would not give up. And in that last week of the New Hampshire primary, he simply didn't sleep. And even though after those two stories, Jennifer and the draft, he had fallen at times to third place. He ended up not winning. People forget
that. Yeah, came in second.
Came in second to Paul Tsongas, who of course was sort of a native son, but it was such a surprising recovery. He labeled himself the comeback kid, and it worked. I mean, that was always a credit where credit is due. That is a joint creation of Mandy Grunwald and Paul Begala. And he went down south and was able to, win in Georgia, and just then keep rolling along, and end up, took Tsongas out in the south, and Kerry hung on for a little longer, but sure enough, at the Illinois primary, he had become the nominee. But even then, by the time he wins Illinois, we're looking at a general election where he was polling in third place.
Behind Ross Perot and George Bush.
And George Bush, yeah. And that was when Perot had decided to run. Now, Bush had his own kind of rocky primary in New Hampshire with Pat Buchanan for the first time. But, was that in...
Yes.
Yeah, it was. He lost it in 96. Dole actually lost to Buchanan, but
Buchanan gave him a hard time.
Gave him a very hard time.
Yeah, and then insinuated his way onto the stage at the convention,
which was a great day for us.
For you guys. One last thing on this, because I want to move on to the White House. You were part of the worst rapid response effort in presidential history, and you may have been part of the best.
Yeah, one of the best.
In that campaign. How much of your experience from 88 informed? I know you had James Carville and Begala and those guys.
If you learned one thing from then, which is something I ended up having to unlearn in the White House, and I think people have had to unlearn even more today. But the driving philosophy of our rapid response was nothing goes unanswered, nothing, and you're fighting it out literally every minute of every day. Now then,
it was a little easier then because you didn't have the.
We had three news cycles, right. Maybe you were going from a one or two news cycle day to maybe three, and we did have some people work all night. But there's no internet. The basic rhythms were still driven by the evening news and the deadlines for the papers, and the morning news to a degree, but not as much as it is today. But it completely different from what people face now, which gets to my point of, I think part of what you guys had to deal with in the Obama campaign, and people have to deal with even more now, is learning what not to respond to.
Yeah,
learning what is noise.
It's easy to chase rabbits down.
Yeah,
you
don't want to be doing that all the time. But we felt, and then at the time it felt new, that that's exactly what we had to do, and it was right for the time.
Yeah, and there was plenty to respond to. Clinton was quite a target then. You went to the White House, and you wrote a very compelling book about this called All Too Human. And in reading the book, it was a mixed experience at best. I mean, the White House, I can attest to, is an incredible place to. You learn more
every minute. I mean, I always say that, and I'm sure you felt the same way. You never feel smarter than when you're in the White House, because you have all the information of the world
right
at your fingertips.
You could call anybody.
You could call anybody at any time. You're generally surrounded by the smartest 8 or 10 people around a table this size
yes
that you're ever going to be working with. And including in both our cases, I think the presidents we worked with, and you're, it met, and every decision matters. So you're playing at your highest level, but a lot of stress comes with that as well.
Yeah. And you wrote about that. Talk about that, the stress that came with the experience.
And part of it was the job I had. You know, I was, at first I was communications director and was doing the briefings, moved on to what more of the role that I had in the campaign of being, you know, sort of a senior policy and strategic advisor. But for Bill Clinton, a lot of that was, and a lot of my particular role was damage control, was on all of the tough stories, and many of them self inflicted, and which meant that I was, in my own mind, often fighting two or three front wars, you know, trying to answer these stories in public, but dealing with many times not knowing all the facts, even after asking many times, not being entirely clear on what was really going on behind the scenes, and dealing with, you know, and I get it, a president or first lady who resented the fact that they had to answer a lot of the questions that they were getting posed, that were being posed to them every day. And that created, you know, a fair amount of stress.
Did you, do you, you know, listening to you, and it probably occurs to you, I could be talking to Sean Spicer.
I've been in the White House a few times this spring. I guess it was in May, and it was, I guess, a week or two before Memorial Day was the last time. And I was in Sean's office. I said, "Hey, you're going to last in the briefings longer than I did."
Yeah.
Turned out he didn't. I mean, that was the next day or that night. In fact, when I was flying back from the White House was when they put out the word that Comey had been fired, which I think, you know, sort of so much has changed or just intensified since then. But yeah, and I've talked to Sean about this. The difference is, I mean, yeah, and I had to deal with my own in the first briefings. You know, Hillary Clinton wanted to close the press office door to the working press between the West Wing and the press office.
So they couldn't roam
around. And that was a big controversy at the time. We went back and forth on televising the briefing, so that controversy is not new at all. The difference is, and I know that a lot of people who listen don't accept this, but there's a difference between advocacy and spin and lying. And there is. And I think that in this White House, the president's spokespeople have been put, and they've put themselves there too, but have been put in untenable positions, you know, for Sean from the first day, trying to make this argument that,
about the crowd.
And then a day later or 3 days later, trying to make the argument about how President Trump would have won, but for the illegal votes in, you know, the popular vote, but for illegal votes.
And then later the tweet about Obama bugging
him. Yeah. I mean, they've had a series of things which are just flat out untrue. And yet they go out and either repeat them or refuse to, you know, correct them or refuse to get an answer from the president, you know, the tapes for 40 something. That's different. That's an entirely different, has an entirely different quality to it.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be right back with George Stephanopoulos. At the end of your tenure at the White House, you guys lost the midterm elections. There were a lot of recriminations. The aforementioned David Wilhelm, a friend of both of ours, was chairman of the Democratic Party and was summarily dispatched. Said he was going back to Chicago where at least they stab you in the front, which I always thought was a great line. And you had your own challenges in the White House because the president had lost confidence in his team.
Right, and it's had a secret team that became less secret, a guy named Dick Morris, his old political consultant, who not only was consulting in secret for a long time, but also was at odds with a lot of the principles that President Clinton had run on.
He wanted to move Clinton to the right. Dick Morris was very promiscuous in his
and about as amoral a guy as you could ever.
He had worked for Jesse Helms. He had spanned the gamut.
And then Trent Lott.
And he had started off as here on the Upper West Side of New York, yep, working for progressives.
Right. He'd been all over the map, and now he's I'm not sure exactly
off the
what
edge
he's doing.
Of the earth.
Yeah, but way right wing. There was a real, after the midterms, I stayed, but there was a real existential struggle inside the White House for the direction of the presidency, for the things we believed in. Ended up in a titanic battle with the then Republican Congress over the budget. Clinton ended up, I give him credit for this, in retrospect, it was a tough, tough fight. I have to say, though, that was one of the more energizing times at the White House, because you felt, even though sometimes it was against people inside your White House, you felt like you were fighting for stuff that really, really mattered. You know, the first
during the government shutdown.
Government shutdown and these huge cuts in Medicaid, that's back right now. You know, one of the ironies, when I think about it, one of the big fights is whether or not you were going to propose a budget that would reach balance. And at the time, Newt Gingrich, Dick Armey, all the Republicans were insisting on a budget that reached balance according to the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, not the OMB. And now, of course, the Congressional Budget Office, it's run by a conservative Republican. That was a big, big fight. Then at the time, we were still battling these stories. You know, you had Paula Jones was filing a lawsuit against the president. There were it would be all over Breitbart if this were today, but about some of his troopers in Arkansas saying that they had helped him get women as well. Things he was all denying, but which started to plant the seeds of future problems. Because at the time, they had appointed
You were for that. You had advised. Am I wrong about this? That you had advised that the special counsel was inevitable, get in front of it and say it was to happen.
I always, this whole debate, and the Clintons still disagree with me on this. Bernie Nussbaum disagrees with me on this.
He's a White House counsel.
Yeah, the idea that this was a choice is fanciful. It's just not true.
It was going to be forced on.
It was whether you were going to ask for it before the five Democrats on the Judiciary Committee who would make the difference. Maybe it was four at the time. We're going to request it anyway, and then it just happens to you.
So your advice was, don't look like you're resisting it because it'll look
like
you're...
Well, it was two pieces of advice where I clashed with
Hillary Clinton,
especially,
right?
and Bernie Nussbaum. And the president was in the middle, and that's why we were having these debates. One was this whole issue of Whitewater. People don't even know what it's about anymore because it was a losing real estate investment
in Arkansas.
of about $20,000, $30,000 in Arkansas back in the 1970s. Now, somehow this had become fodder for the special counsel, but there had already been one special counsel who had looked at it and saw that there was nothing wrong. And I made the argument, this was even before that, I guess, that whatever papers you have, give them to the press.
Because they're going to get them.
They're going to get them eventually anyway. Let them write the stories, and then we can move on. They didn't do that, and that's what led to the first special counsel.
Let me ask you a question about this. As you watch this last campaign and the way Hillary Clinton dealt with some of her issues, the speeches that she gave that she didn't disclose, the sort of slow rolling story of the email.
Familiar.
Yeah.
Everybody's got their mix of gifts and flaws. And this is, I think, one thing that is pretty consistent in the Clinton history and in Hillary Clinton's history is that, you know, for all her commitment to public service, which is deep, lifelong, and policy smarts, which is also off the charts, she has a tough shell and a very protective shell and feels burned by the press and burned by the public and just gets into a protective crouch over things that feel personal to her. And, you know, the email was one example. The speeches is another. example, she feels like she's being held to a different standard, so she hunkers down. And I would, you know, I don't think she's necessarily wrong that she's held to a different standard, but that's life. That's politics. Right. That happens, you know, and you have to deal with the world as it comes sometimes.
Yeah.
But yeah. And you know, when I really felt it and it turned out, ended up not to be the biggest deal in the world, but it wasn't helpful. That Sunday when she fainted,
I was very critical of her then.
But I remember I called Nick
Merrill.
There
was a 6-hour gap between her fainting and them acknowledging that she had pneumonia, essentially.
And I called Nick Merrill when he came up with that first statement of, I don't even remember what he said, but I knew it just didn't.
Dehydrate or something on a hot day or something.
And I just said, Nick, and I didn't even know anything. This was just purely based on intuition and experience. I said, Nick, I don't think you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think you know. And sure enough, you know.
Yeah, and what was interesting later, was I had the sense she didn't want to talk about that because she was being attacked by by Rudy Giuliani and the Trump people about not being fit.
Yeah, and Giuliani, I mean, what was Trump's word then? It was one of his words he was using about whether she was. Oh, you know, actually, it wasn't one word. It was just, yeah, she barely campaigns.
Right. So that was their meme. But I think, you know, I tweeted that day that I'm embarrassed to always start a sentence that way. But I tweeted that day that the issue is stealth, not health. And she exacerbated what was her deepest problem, which was trust.
Right.
It didn't turn out to be the biggest deal, but it sure.
But it was illustrative. But then you put yourself, though, and this is where I get then can flip it around and say, put yourself in her shoes. She's running against someone who, you know, demonstrably on several different occasions just says stuff that's flat out not true. You know, I saw thousands of Muslims,
right,
cheering on 9/11, he's all over the map on policy. He's not releasing his taxes. And she's thinking, you're hitting me for being secretive?
Right, right. But as you say, politics ain't fair, and
right,
you got to deal with it as you...
But I do think...
I think there was too much reliance, frankly, on his deficiencies. There was too much of a sense that people would see that and would, you know...
Clearly, in retrospect, definitely.
Yeah. Let me just, because I don't want to run out of time here, because I want to come back to Trump and the media.
Mm-hmm.
But you made this leap after leaving the White House. And when I quit my job at the Chicago Tribune, Doug Neeland, who was an editor at the Tribune, I always remember he told me, you know, you'll never be able to come back if you cross this line. But you were a very visible partisan, and you were able to make the leap.
Well, and I wasn't the first who did that. I mean,
Tim Russert.
Tim Russert had done it, and he worked for Governor Cuomo. Actually, Diane Sawyer.
Yes, who worked for Richard Nixon.
Worked for Richard Nixon. Bill Moyers, mm-hmm, had done it. Worked for Lyndon Johnson. I think generally, by the time I came along, there was more like you get one move, mm-hmm, you just don't get to go back,
right?
And forth. But when I first left, I didn't know for sure this was what I was going to do. I came on to ABC, although now it turns out I've been there 20 years, been here 20 years, as an analyst, as a, you know, sort of a with a point, mm-hmm, of view. It was only over time that I made that a full time job and moved on to reporting and anchoring. But I knew that I had, in order to be accepted in this role, had to be sort of transparent about it. And I had different rules for myself at different times. When I was a pundit, an analyst, I sort of felt the best way that I could be true to my past work and true to the job of being an analyst was to basically say on the air what I would say in a meeting in the White House, which would not necessarily agree with what the president did, but would, you know, sort of be true to the arguments I made, mm-hmm, at the time. As a, you know, when I started to become a reporter and an anchor, I knew that people were skeptical, and I just had to be scrupulous about, and we've actually talked about this before, but two things. One, being fair to both sides, but also not overcompensating and ending just to look like you're being tougher on the side you used to work on. And that was a balancing act for a long time, but I always knew it was going to be up to the viewers, and the people I was covering to determine whether or not I was doing a fair job.
And it had, was it hard for you to sort of shed the mantle of partisanship?
You know,
you know, if this were television, that pause would be read as yes.
Yes. Well, it is. I was thinking of the honest way to answer it. It took time.
Yeah.
And it definitely took time. Now, one of the things that, you know, that sort of ended up complicating it, that was kind of a fraught time. While this is happening, you know, the whole Monica Lewinsky thing blows up. This is all after I left the White House. And
yeah, it's tough to comment on that.
Well, yes and no. I mean, this goes back to the point I was trying to make about what I felt like the way to be true to myself was to make the arguments I would have been making inside. And the truth was that, you know, I was appalled by this. You know, when I went to work for Bill Clinton in 1991, 92, he had already, part of the reason he didn't run in 1988, people thought, was because of these questions about his personal behavior. And I was defending him against charges that I was told were untrue for years. But the whole implicit and to some degree explicit bargain was, or contract was, you know, you're going to put people out to defend you on this, but that means you're not going to, you know, make the problem worse. You know, you're in the White House now.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that was just, you know, should he have been impeached for it? No, but, and, you know, incredibly reckless and irresponsible and selfish act. And that's what I said as a commentator. And
probably wasn't well received at the White House.
Probably.
Did you hear from them or others?
Others, but, you know, it was a pretty fraught time. I heard from a lot of different people.
You did get into a jam a couple of years ago. You're an incredibly generous person. My own, you know, a foundation I'm very close to, you've been a supporter of, and you gave some contributions to the Clinton Foundation. Yeah. And you've acknowledged that probably the optics of that probably were not good, even if the intentions were.
I mean, I don't think there was anything. I think it's a good charity, and I'm glad I supported it in that respect, but it was dumb given the role I had. I would say that when I was making these contributions, this was a time when, you know, Mitt Romney was chairing the Clinton Initiative. It became something different. It looked different in the middle of the campaign, and I should have had, even though I did disclose it, I should have had more disclosures than mm-hmm. I had, and I certainly cop to that. But
it may have cost you a presidential debate.
Yes, it may have. Well, it definitely cost me a Republican debate.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well,
that's life.
Yeah, right.
I just want to ask you one question about your dual-hatted role. I mean, you really wear three hats at ABC, you know, as their sort of chief anchor and on Good Morning America and the Sunday show. The Good Morning America piece, which is an incredible franchise for ABC, you know, you people know you as the guy on Sunday who's challenging policymakers on.
Some people do. That's the thing.
Yeah, but then
GMA is very different.
Yeah.
Actually, I think you were my first interview on GMA.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, you were my first actual interview.
But it wasn't on cooking or anything.
It was. No, it wasn't. yeah, it was a different.
I mean, how do you how have you embraced that role? And what's the upside of it? I mean, obviously the upside.
The upside. It turns out. I mean, again, when I sort of felt I actually said no to the job three times, but. The more I said no, the more it became clear to me that I was putting a pretty hard ceiling on my career if I said no. Yeah, you can say no.
Yeah.
But
you ain't going anywhere.
You're not going anywhere. I would never be the chief anchor. I would never be doing the anchoring election night, anything like that, if I said no. This was, they needed.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been there?
Long time now, 7 years.
Yeah. You look at the television news numbers. Obviously, there are a lot more outlets now, but it's not encouraging in terms of the trajectory. Morning television may be in better shape
morning and Sunday are in better shape than anything else.
So good
Sunday,
for you.
Sunday is getting, we're getting the same numbers, in some cases better than we were getting 8-10 years ago. I mean, both Obama and it was actually the tougher time was the early 2000s. Obama brought back a lot of interest in politics.
And Trump
has done the same.
Like a shiny object.
Yeah, Trump has done the same.
Let me ask you one question on that. Do you think Trump obviously has a real instinct for self-promotion and understands television in a
yes and no, but yeah.
But he, well, certainly the cable.
He understands
that if you light
universe.
Yourself on fire, that people are going to turn their cameras on, and he lit himself on fire. Did he game television news?
Well, this gets
back
to something we were talking about. This goes back to the Hillary conversation as well. He clearly gamed cable. Well, no, and any game, I could argue he gamed all of us. I mean, obviously, he thought a lot about this. And
I mean, he'd call into your Sunday shows. Everybody let him do that.
Right.
Nobody else really got to do that.
Now, actually, no one else actually ever thought of it. That's the problem.
Well, that's my point.
So that's the way that he gamed it. But, you know, I'm of two minds of this, because a lot of the people who would complain about how much coverage we were giving him, we'd invite them on every day. They wouldn't come on.
Right.
I mean, he had and this goes back to when I look at my own role in this, and, you know, did we do something wrong? Were we not fair? Did we give him too much coverage? I look at every interview I did. They were tough interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And again, these were interviews that if other people gave the answers he gave, and not just to me, but to others as well, in a different world, they were interviews and answers that politicians just didn't survive. You know, whether it's, you know, attacking John McCain for his time as a prisoner of war when you didn't go.
How
to
many
dinner.
Times during that campaign did the political intelligentsia say, that's it, he's never going to survive this?
Well, I remember one big interview I did was after their convention. I flew out to Colorado, and that was the interview where he, Democratic convention, where he attacked Khazir Khan and his wife. And I remember walking out of the interview, and President Trump, he was very mad at me. And he was, you know, really as angry as I've ever seen him. And he was yelling at me, but it was about a different part of the interview. It was about the questions I had been asking him about Putin, which, again, on their own would have been.
He seems testy on that subject. I don't know why. Where do you think this is all going? I mean, coverage of the presidency and the presidency itself. You've got a perspective on both.
Well,
those
I would think on the having worked in a White House that was under the thumb of the special counsel for several years, they have no idea. Once the special counsel starts, and certainly Ken Starr did, remember he was appointed 2 years before Monica Lewinsky came into the White House. That's what ended up being what Bill Clinton got impeached over.
Yeah.
Special counsels can go in any direction they want.
I think they have some idea, which is why he seems to be laying the predicate for, or at least Newt Gingrich and others are laying the predicate for somehow removing Mueller, which seems like a cataclysmic decision if they make it.
You would think, having just read a book I would recommend to all of your listeners, a fantastic new biography of Richard Nixon by John Farrell.
Yes, Jack
Farrell. It's, and it brings you back to the Watergate times and the Saturday Night Massacre. I can't imagine a president surviving a move like that. But he's defied But in this case, perhaps it's different. If you try to think this one through, the deputy attorney general is now in charge of Mueller, who would have to do it. Rod Rosenstein is not going to fire Robert Mueller. So he's going to resign.
Yeah. No, that's why this is Saturday Night Massacre territory.
Yeah. Squared or cubed.
No, I think that's break glass time if they do that. Listen, we could talk about this, and I suspect we will be talking about this quite a bit. I just want to say the reason why you have a faithful audience is that you bring the passion of someone who has been a practitioner and who understands the process and who has reverence for it.
I do have reverence for it. I mean, that's what you were saying about my time in the White House is, you know, it was a mixed experience. That's true. And maybe this is looking back with rose-colored glasses. Peak professional experience of my life. How could it not be? I mean, to have that kind of privilege, to have that kind of chance to work on what you care about at the highest level in a way that matters every single day is once in a lifetime.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Well, that comes shining through in your coverage and in your conversations each Sunday and during the week, and I appreciate you, and I appreciate being with you
today. This was fun. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.